The Bible teaches us that God is in control. The Bible teaches us that God is wise, that He's good. You know, it's hard right now, for being frank with ourselves, to look at our own circumstances, to look at the world around us, and to maybe call that into question. There's a lot that can happen in life in general and in our own lives that can really call God's wisdom into question. Right? How can a God who allows global pandemic be considered good? We're all right now in this circumstance of just trying to process our life and process things that are going around us and dealing with the uncertainty of what might lie ahead. It's natural for us to sit here and to say, God, where are you? Or God, what are you doing? But even just beyond our present circumstances, can a God who allows rape, who allows murder, who allows child abuse, who allows the loss of a child or the loss of a spouse, can a God who allows genocide, who allows cancer, who allows a job loss, can that God really be trusted? Is God really wise? And is God's way of ordering the world, is it really the best way? Simply put, there's a reason in the Old Testament, when you get to the wisdom literature section, there's a reason that that section begins with the book of Job. Because before we can start to heed God's wisdom, we have to first decide, are we willing to trust this God? You see, the book of Job isn't about suffering per se, or about why suffering happens. This book doesn't endeavor to explain all the reasons for our suffering or all the reasons for our hardship. Instead, this book offers to us the reasons for righteousness. God's policies, the way that He interacts with His creation, that really is what is on trial in this book. Is God worth trusting, and is His wisdom really best? This book, it forces us to ask, will we question God? Will we question the ways that He operates the world? Or will we just simply trust in Him? And so what we have in the opening chapter of the book of Job is more than just important plot points in this story. And I would encourage you to get your Bibles out and to go to Job 1 just so that you can follow along as we talk through here. Because what this chapter does, along with chapter 2, is it sets up the fundamental question of this book and really of all human existence. How does God run the world? And Job 1 teaches us that the true fear of God and worshipful relationship with Him is never built upon any incentives we might receive or think we might receive from Him. Now, the picture we get when we open Job is almost fairy tale-like. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. The story begins almost as if to say, once upon a time, in a land far, far away. Or maybe more appropriately, to say a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. The serene, almost peaceful setting that we're given here, it continues even as Job is described. We're told that that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. You see, Job is of devout moral character. He is the epitome, we're to believe, of practical wisdom. The fact that he's described as blameless doesn't mean that he is without sin or he is perfect. No, Genesis 17 defines blamelessness as simply a life of close relationship with God. And so we see that Job, he respects God's standards, he respects His character, and so he is seeking to live his life in an honest way out of reverence for God and for His righteousness. And so while he is by no means sinless, the prologue does paint Job as a man who seeks to honor God with his life. And on top of his blameless character, we'll soon find that life is pretty good for Job. He's so wealthy that he is described as the greatest of all the peoples in the East. He enjoys a large, healthy family. He has no material wants at all. And yet, amazingly, his wealth doesn't prove to be a hindrance to his worship. that he is wealthy doesn't get in the way of his faith and worship of God. Instead, we read that he regularly offers intercessions and sacrifices for both himself as well as for his entire family. And there's no indication that his children need these sacrifices. Job simply offers them in the case of inadvertent sin or inadvertent blasphemy. And so at the beginning of this story, Job's life seems to be near perfect. And he himself seems to be near perfect. Of course, he's not. And neither is he totally wise. God is instead going to use his suffering to teach him true wisdom and trust. And neither is Job's faith at the beginning of this story perfect. And that's why Satan comes and makes the accusation he does of Job. But before we get to that accusation, we need to understand the purpose of this picture that we're given in the opening verses of this book. You see, first it's noteworthy that Job is not a Jew. He's outside of Israel. He's outside of the covenantal nation. And so his story and his experiences, they really transcend Israel. How God will interact with him. It's true then of not just how God interacts with his covenantal people, but how God interacts with all of humanity. Second, Job's ethnicity means that his suffering is also representative for all humanity. The questions that he will ask about his own suffering and the answers, the supposed wisdom that he and his friends will give, we can find ourselves in this scenario. We ought to put ourselves in this story. And by doing so, we can not only see ourselves honestly in a mirror, but we can also then receive God's response and God's words and his answers. Because you see, a lot of the hardship that we see detailed in the New Testament, it often has to do with the persecution and the hatred of the children of God because of their allegiance to King Jesus. All right, my point is that the New Testament authors, they tend to focus on the hardships that we will endure as we seek to follow Jesus. But in addition to that persecution that, yes, the church endures, when we're frank with ourselves, there's also just a lot of hardship and suffering that we experience in life that has nothing to do with our Christian faith, right? Right now, COVID-19, it is affecting Christian and non-Christian alike. It is moving indiscriminately throughout this world. And so as many of the epistles of the New Testament address the suffering that will come into our lives as a result of following Jesus, Job addresses the suffering that comes into our lives simply as a result of living in a fallen world. And so as we ask about our own circumstances, Job's experience shows us how we should respond in difficult times of life in general. But verses 6 through 12 really raise an important question about Job and again, about us. Whereas verses 1 through 5 show us that Job fears God in everything, that he is blessed by God in everything. The next paragraph asks, though, is Job's fear of God, meaning his reverential worship, is Job's fear tied to the benefits of serving God? Of course, before we get to that question, we have to address the obvious, perplexing scenario of verses 6 and 7, right? As you just look at these verses, you ask yourself, who are these sons of God who come and present themselves? Who is the Satan? Why does he come as well? Why does God speak to him in the way that he does? And what is the purpose of the Satan in all of this? You see, this scene seems to be taking place in the heavenly places. And so the sons of God are likely the angelic hosts of God who serve him and serve his will. But then we read that the Satan comes and joins them. And save for the New Living Translation, every other major English translation simply calls him Satan. Hopefully, though, as you're looking at your scriptures right now, you'll see a little note beside that word Satan, and that note at the bottom of your page will make mention that the Hebrew text literally says the Satan. In other words, the book of Job doesn't use the word Satan as a name, but rather as a title. Because in Hebrew, that word Satan means simply the adversary or the accuser. Same thing over in Zechariah 3, where there's one who comes to accuse Joshua the high priest, and he is called the Satan, the adversary, the accuser. And so some Old Testament scholars have looked at this, and they argue, okay, that this agent we meet here in verse 6 is not the same person we know in the New Testament to be the devil or the arch enemy of God. Instead, this is simply the Satan. This is some angel who has the responsibility of bringing inquiries about human beings. And that could be the case. It's very vague. The text doesn't tell us a whole lot about this figure here. But I believe that the tone of Job 1 and 2 indicates otherwise, because while the original readers of this book, who do not have the complete revelation of God like we do with the New Testament, while they don't have the full, complete picture of Satan that we have, I believe that the text itself shows us that this accuser or this adversary is no neutral or innocent agent. Right, because what do we see him doing? He is charging an innocent and good man with doing evil. It's the exact same thing we see over in Revelation 12. Because here in Job 1, his tone, his words, they have this certain insidiousness to them. In other words, I don't think you need to read the New Testament to realize that this Satan here in Job 1 is not a good guy. Of course, if we get ourselves too bogged down in these details, we run the risk of missing the bigger picture here, right? Because the narrator of this book, right, the person telling the story of Job, he presents this scene about God and Satan for our benefit, right? There's something bigger that he is communicating to us. The purpose of verses 6 through 12 is for the reader's instruction. Because Job will never learn that this scene has taken place. Right? He'll never find out, neither will his friends, that the reason he suffered was because of this exchange. And so the narrator is giving it not for Job's sake, but for ours. Because the fact of the matter is, we don't understand suffering. We don't understand the way God always works. We don't understand why he allows the things that he does. And so the book of Job, as I've already intimated, is a trial of God's policies. God intends to teach Job and all of us something about himself and about what he desires of us. And so this scene here, it's given to feed that purpose. Does Job fear God for no reason? In other words, it's the reason that Job worships, it's the reason that Job serves God, that he fears God, is because there's some material blessing in it for himself. I mean, because it would seem that really God's policies of blessing the righteous person, because they're righteous, well, there's a flaw in there. There seems that there's something wrong in the way that God works. One commentator puts it like this, that if God makes a policy to bring prosperity as a reward for righteousness, true righteousness will be subverted because people will always act righteously in order to gain benefits. God, therefore, by his very policy, is creating mercenaries of a sort, people who will do anything to get ahead. What do you think about that? I think that's a really timely critique for every generation. Do we worship God? Do we come to church? Do we do the right thing because we believe there's something in it for us? Do we fear God for something or for nothing? I mean, is this not the great underlying incentive behind the prosperity gospel, right? That if you'll just simply do these things, if you have the faith, if you have the belief, if you name it, if you claim it, well, then God will bless you mightily in your life. I mean, the logic of humanity has been pretty consistent throughout the ages. Do good, and good things will come to you. Do bad, and bad things will come to you. The book of Job shows us really just how imperfect this principle really is. But I think that this question is valid for us to ask personally. Do we as Christians, do we fear God just so we can go to heaven one day? So that we can avoid hell? I mean, I think about, especially in American evangelicalism, how we just so often emphasize the things of God rather than God Himself. We paint this wonderful picture of heaven, and we inadvertently leave God out of it. Right? Even sometimes the way we share our faith perpetuates this inclination, promoting the things of salvation rather than simply the joy of God Himself. I've often found myself convicted by this quote from John Piper. He says, the critical question for our generation and for every generation is this: if you could have heaven with no sickness and with all the friends you ever had on earth and all the food you ever liked and all the leisure activities you ever enjoyed and all the natural beauties that you ever saw, all the physical pleasures you ever tasted, and no human conflict or any natural disasters, could you be satisfied with heaven if Christ was not there? And Job 1 should cause us to pause and to ask, do I fear God? Do I worship God? Do I serve God because of something I expect to get out of it? Or simply because He's God? The book of Job, it raises this question of whether or not God's blessing of His people proves to be their chief incentive for righteousness. Of course, what's the alternative though, right? Let's go to the other side. Because while it may seem unjust to reward righteousness, it also seems unjust for God to allow righteous people to suffer, right? I mean, is God not supposed to bless Job here? Right? I mean, if He's potentially unjust in blessing the righteous, well, does that mean He should withhold blessing from the righteous? That would seem wrong as well. Indeed, that would be the complaint that Job and his friends that they raise over and over again. In other words, the prologue of this book is really centering on asking, what is God supposed to do? How does He run this world? And is He worthy of our trust? What should be our response to God in times of good and in times of hardship? It's funny, but it would seem that no matter what God does, He falls short of what we as human beings consider to be just and right. One other wrinkle to our discussion. I want you to note that it's God Himself who brings up Job. It's not the Satan who brings up Job, but it's God. And we see that the Satan is not allowed to do anything to Job outside the permission of God. And so what you have here is not a case of God versus Satan. This is not a wager or a scenario where the result is unknown. God knows how this story is going to turn out. And so frankly, He's unconcerned with proving anything to the Satan. I mean, the Satan makes a bold accusation, right? Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. In other words, the accuser's main interest here is to prove that when humans are faced with the reality of a fallen and broken world, that our faith in God will not hold up. And so it would seem at this point, God has to make a response to the Satan. He has to prove him wrong, but he doesn't. God has no interest in demonstrating the righteousness of His ways to Satan. He has no interest in even proving it to the heavenly court. Now, what does He aim to do here? He is aiming to teach Job something. God intends to teach us something, that even when we cannot understand His ways, that nevertheless His ways are still perfect. That He is sovereign over all of creation. That He exhibits perfect control according to His perfect wisdom. And so even in hardship, even when we suffer greatly, even when we lose everything, that we're still to trust Him. The remainder of chapter 1 then shows us what this proper response looks like. Again, the prose here is highly poetic. We see four messengers come from four different directions. These four calamities corresponding to the four corners of the earth, representing just the totality of Job's losses. He loses it all, his fortune, his family, everything in one moment. And he's devastated. Right? I don't think we see the beauty of his worship unless we capture the devastation of his emotion. He performs this customary mourning ritual of tearing his clothing, shaving his head. And yet, in the midst of this pain, in the midst of this loss, in the midst of this anguish, he falls to the ground and worships. His faith is not subverted by suffering. He uses the personal covenantal name of God, Yahweh, which demonstrates that even in this calamity, his devotion to God remains steadfast. He remarks famously, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." As one commentator notes, this affirmation indicates that Job recognizes that Yahweh is sovereign over all of life, including both the good and the bad features. So there are no accidents in his universe. In other words, as verse 22 states, Job remains faithful. He remains steadfast in fearing God simply because God is God. Meaning that we worship God. We trust Him, not because of what He grants us or because of what benefit there may be to us. We worship God simply because He is God. As Jesus taught, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Job's treasure is not measured in his possessions or even in his family. Job's treasure isn't golden streets or future rewards. Job's treasure is simply God Himself. And so ask yourself then, right? Put yourself in Job's circumstance. In heartbreak, in hardship, in loss, in fear, in isolation, in loneliness, in suffering, in sickness, do you still fall to the ground and worship? When the Lord gives and He takes away, do you still bless His name regardless? I think all of us right now in some way or another are going through hardship, loss of just community, maybe loss of income, just loss of peace. We're dealing with fear, we're feeling with anxiety. You may be watching this, and you yourself may have been infected by the coronavirus. I don't have many doubts, call me a cynic, but I don't have many doubts that in these days to come, that each of us, ourselves personally, or at least someone we know, will be affected by this virus. This will not just be this obscure thing that is affecting other people in other parts of the world or in very great big cities throughout the U.S. It's going to affect us as well. It's going to touch each and every one of us. We're all going through some sort of hardship right now. But even just beyond COVID-19, even maybe before any of this started, some of us were dealing with loss of relationships, the loss and death of loved ones, other personal diseases and pains, in someone we knew, injustice, wickedness, poverty, whatever it is. I ask you, friend, that through the pain and through the loss, is the chief response of your life still that of worship? You know, others of us right now may be enjoying abundance. You may be a wealthy introvert. You have everything that you need in your comfortable home, in your comfortable setting. And so frankly, not to be insensitive, but this whole thing is kind of a staycation for you, and you're doing well. But I would ask you, is your faith, is your worship, is it rooted in those comforts? If your health and your wealth and your comfort were to suddenly leave you right now, would you still as vigorously worship and bless the name of the Lord? Is His immense blessing on your life a catalyst for worship? Friend, we're just asking, do we worship and fear God for something or simply for nothing? Do we bless His name because of what we expect to receive in return? Or do we bless His name out of an awe and reverence for who He simply is? Can you say, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away? Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, you might be sitting here right now saying to yourself, this is absurd. Right? I mean, when we look at the book of Job and we ask, can God be trusted? And then you look at this scene of Job 1, maybe your first response is, no. He can't be trusted. I mean, I believe that if God really is all good and He is all powerful, well, then He should give and bless. I cannot trust in a God who takes away. Maybe Job 1 just fuels your skepticism about the validity of the Christian faith. And if that's you, if you're the skeptic, let me just say this. It's okay that you feel that way. Job is going to feel that way. He's going to have some major questions about God come up during this time. But let me also say to the skeptic, you're not alone. Every single one of us, including myself, struggles with really understanding God and trusting Him. Every single one of us struggles with fearing God for something we think we're going to get in return. We can all easily slip into this mercenary mindset where we find ourselves bought by the good things. And so if you're a skeptic, it's okay. I'm glad you're here and listening and watching. You're not alone. Because any Christian being honest with themselves right now will no doubt look at this passage and see places in their life where their faith and their trust is weak. And so, Christian, let me challenge you right now. Because I imagine that you're seeing places in your heart where maybe you're fearing the Lord for His things rather than for His person. Maybe for some of you this morning, the pain of your circumstance is so great and it is so burdensome that even though you want to worship, you just don't have it in you. Maybe for some of you this day, you're angry at God or you're disappointed in Him. You know what your response is supposed to be, but you're struggling to actually mean it. And I don't know, maybe for some of us, as you look at the end of Job 1, you don't question what Job says and does here. You just personally can't do it yourself. Satan seems to be right. He seems to be winning, and you seem to be failing. These kinds of struggles, these kinds of doubts that we all have, it leads me to think, though, of Zechariah 3, that passage I mentioned earlier, where the Satan once again makes an accusation. And on what grounds does he make that accusation? He makes it on the grounds that Joshua, and Joshua representing the people of God, that they are clothed in filthy garments. Right? That's his accusation. Because you see, the filthy garments represents the sin of the people. It represents their failure. It represents their inadequacies to live righteously for God. And so the Satan rightly stands there and he says, look at these sinners. These faithless people. And Satan, he's right. None of us can stand righteously before the Lord. Because all of us, because of the frailty of the human heart, all of us struggle to worship God, or we struggle to worship Him solely for His sake. And the Satan stands there ready to accuse you. But as he does, how does God respond? God says, behold, I have taken your iniquity away from you, and I will clothe you with pure vestments. God takes our failure away. He takes our weakness away. He doesn't condemn us. Just as He will not condemn Job for his weakness throughout this story. Instead, what God does is He clothes us with His own righteousness, and He accepts us. And how can He do that? Well, because of the person and the work of Jesus Christ. You see, while Job never curses God's name, Job does buckle under the pressure of his suffering. But God became man. God Himself, in human form, He suffered and He never buckled. As the author of the Hebrews tells us, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with us in our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. In Jesus, our failures before God were taken away, and His righteousness clothed us. The only way that you can actually worship God then, the only way that you can actually fear Him in reverence, is through the salvation and the power of Jesus Christ. It's Jesus who shows us that our suffering is not in vain. It's Jesus who strengthens us in our hardships. It's Jesus who brings us into a relationship with God where we may now worship and bless His name. And so as we explore this question of who God is and whether or not He can be trusted, the answer to that question rests in Jesus alone. If you're struggling to worship right now, or if you're seeing places in your life where you are indeed worshiping God for something, look to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now seated at the right hand of the throne of God. As I said earlier, Job was completely aware of how his hardships were from this heavenly scenario. And we never find out, even on top of that, why was Job, of all people, chosen for this? And you know what? Likewise, we don't understand always why God allows our hardships. We don't understand right now why God is allowing a global pandemic. We don't know why He sometimes takes away from us. We often do not have the answers in this life. But the book of Job shows us that regardless of our understanding, we're to trust Him. And in Jesus Christ, we can do that. Whether He gives or whether He takes His way, in Jesus, we can bless the name of the Lord. Bless His name.